This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Jiadun Silongkumar, the host of this channel. And today I'm here with Dr. Vipa Joshi to talk about A Matter of Belief, Christian Conversion and Healing in Northeast India. I think not only this book, but then the author and the work itself is fascinating to me because my PhD work is also on the same people in Nagaland, among Nagas. And I think we have a lot of similarities in that sense of our topic of research and also the kind of the outworking, the theoretical and the methodological outworking that has been carried out here. So I believe this conversation will be a very interesting and also at the same time fruitful for everyone, especially for me at the same time, since I am also working in this area as an anthropologist. So before going into the discussion of the book and our work, let me straight away go to Dr. Vipa Joshi to tell her something about herself. Yeah, ma'am, can you please tell us something about yourself?
Thank you, Tiatim Su, for inviting me to talk about my book. About myself, I'm an anthropologist, but my journey did not begin as an anthropologist. My first degree was in zoology honors from Miranda House in Delhi University. Then I moved to doing an MSc in anthropology. And there I really found archaeology and social anthropology very interesting, not so much as biological anthropology, because I had already learned that in zoology. So it seemed like repetition. But then I became very interested. And our MSc class, in second year, we had a paper on fieldwork. So those who have done anthropology would know that it's a compulsory paper and you have to produce a dissertation, and the whole class visits a particular region, a village, and does a village study. And everybody takes a different topic. So my class of 9 students and 2 teachers ended up doing a village study of Jotsuma village in Nagaland. So that was my actual first time into Nagaland and to do a study. And the topic that I ended up choosing, because everyone was so quick in choosing their top topics, that I ended up choosing on traditional healers. So that was my introduction. I was always interested in healing of different kinds. So, but my father had been was posted in Nagaland in the 1960s, before I was born. So I had always seen, things, cloths and baskets and spears and bamboo mugs and things in my house, and had heard about Nagaland. Plus, I had friends in college. In Miranda House, there were many students from Nagaland who were in the hostel. And also my brother, their colleagues were from Nagaland in the civil services. So it's not that, it was something that I didn't know of and I had not met the people, but actually going to the region was a new thing. So that was the introduction. And it just so happens that after that, I did an MPhil, but in a different area in central India. Then I got a scholarship to come to study in Oxford to do my MPhil. And Oxford, the thing was that I had heard about Peterborough's Museum. Dr. Alan McFarlane had just started a big project on Nadia Naga video disc. I actually came to know about the project much after choosing Oxford rather than Cambridge. I had a choice between these two universities. The project was based at Cambridge. But a lot of things that were used in that project were from the Peterborough's Museum collections and archives in Oxford. Anyway, I joined Oxford, and there I did the secondary literature survey for my MPhil thesis, and that was on religion and healing. So I looked at the Naga monographs and other material that was available in the library. Now, one thing that is very interesting is that there is so much material, published material and archives available in UK. And so one would think that why am I going all the way to UK to study about a region which is actually in India? But it's the secondary source material and also the primary source material, which was easily available actually in UK than in India, where I would have had to scour different libraries and go all over the place to find even the published material. So that was one thing. And then I sort of took a break. I came back to India and I did several projects, and I got to do projects in Nagaland. I was the only one from that batch who continued to work in Nagaland with the people. So the focus was on Angami Naga villages. So it was a multi-sided study. So that is how my introduction was. And then I ended up doing doctoral studies. And because I did several projects in between, I completed my doctoral studies only in 2001. So though I had been working with Nagaland since 1985 was the first visit. And from 1990s, I went to Nagaland to do a project on a pictorial book with a very well-known photographer called Aditya Arya, who has actually now opened something called Museo Camera in Gurgaon. And that book should have come out in 94, but it was published 10 years later in 2004. So that was very interesting because that was the first time I managed to actually travel around Nagaland and also meet different communities and people. But my interest in traditional healing practices and religion was such that I kept collecting information and meeting people. And I did various projects for IGNCA. I joined IGNCA. I did a project there. Then I did a project on handicrafts for the Development Commissioner of Handicrafts. But every time I visited Nagaland, my interest in the healing and religion practices of the Angami was also taken care of.
Yeah.
So that's why in my book I write that my fieldwork goes from 1985 till now. I could be working on any project, but I keep hearing about healers and healing,
yeah,
and religion and church services.
Thank you very much for the very elaborate explanation about your background, and also it also shows where this book is coming from in that sense. Now, you have mentioned about your engagement and involvement with the Angami Nagas, but again, I want to emphasize this question as to coming to the healing and conversion, why specifically the Angami Nagas? I'm sure now when we study the Naga community, obviously we cannot segregate only the Angami Nagas. It's more of a holistic thing, but then in your mind, why the Angami Nagas?
As I said earlier, that in my MSc, we had done a village study of Jotsupa village, which is an Angami Naga village. And part of the land of Jotsupa village has Kohima Science College. And we were the guest of Kohima Science College. So the introduction was already there. So our teachers had told us not to read Hutton's monograph on the Angami Nagas. Go as a tabula rasa, go in the village and try and find out. So we did. So we found out, all of us doing different topics. So, and after that, I read, when we came back, then we were allowed to read. So as to not to be influenced by the monograph. So that's a very interesting technique that our teachers used, the lecturers. And Professor Vinay Srivastava is a very well-known anthropologist in India. And he was a very young anthropologist. And he was one of the teachers who had accompanied us to the village. So yes, so because my introduction was already done by the village study of Jotsuma, so I continued. And so, I mean, that was also there. Plus also, you must understand, Nagaland, as you as a Naga would understand, that it's not very easy to enter Nagaland. So as an Indian, I need an inner line permit. Inner line permit is for 10 days. And then I have to have a guarantor in Nagaland to stay further. And I have to give my photograph, go to district commissioner office, get a stamp, and then I'm allowed to stay for another 3 months. So these are the fieldwork things that many people do not know. So for all that, I had to be in, and now also I knew people in Kohima. They were, I had met them through my siblings. Plus they were people from the students who had studied in college, and they were also around in Kohima and Dimapur. So sometimes it is also, and I'm talking about 1990s and then later on in 2000s. So the kind of network that was there, and having already done work on Jyotsma and on Angami healing traditions. So the familiarity, and that's why I ended up working with the Angami.
Now, I'm sure some of the listeners will know about Nagas, but since this new book network is a worldwide network of publishing podcasts, so many people won't know about Nagaland and the Nagas and the colonialism and how Christianity came and all. So can you give a brief background to colonialism in this part of India, and also the influence of Christianity in the initial stage?
Okay, now I'll say that how I actually came on to studying Christianity. I was working on traditional healers, but some traditional healers had converted to Christianity. Now that suddenly opened my mind. Okay, I'm here on traditional religion and healing, but the healers have converted to Christianity. So how did this come about? Now that itself, I mean, even the existence of Nagaland as a state itself is related to colonization and Indian independence and other things that were happening. So what is known as Nagaland was part of the Naga Hills district and the northeast hill frontier area. I mean, there were sort of different reorganizations of the region. So to make it simpler, I will say that it was part of the larger area region called Assam, which was the administrative unit. And within that, it was Naga Hills. And the British administration that came in from what I've read and understood, was also, it was extractive resources that were needed. There was oil, then the tea plantation had just begun in 1830s. And then they were trying to find a road also to connect to Burma. So all these, I mean, there were several other works have taken care of this. But so in the 1830s, and around that time, there was also a treaty of Yandabo between the British and the Burmese. And so there are all these kind of different regional historical events that were taking place in the northeast part of India. So the Naga, who were divided into different communities, as we learned from the British sources, okay, and from the Ahom Burunjias, who call Nagas according to their village, the prominent village. So you have Bonpara Naga, this Naga, that Naga, but not as Ao, Angami, or Sumi. So there are different names that have been given, and each the Naga that the Naga itself is an outside term for a collection of people, you know. As it is known in other parts of the world, with colonization comes missionization. So there were different missionary groups in Assam. And it just so happened that American Baptists who were in Burma mission, they started also looking into Assam. So they came over to Assam. And the first attempt was made in 1830s, mid-30s, by someone called Bronson, to go and do evangelization. But the other idea was also to have Naga interested in tea cultivation. And there was support from the Britishers. And then with the tea cultivation, and because for tea cultivation, a lot of land that was part of the Naga hunting land and the trade routes, because they would come down to the plains to trade. So all that was taken up by the British. And this was actually not the you would think of East India Company, actually. That was the one that was involved. So all that is the historical thing. And to stop Nagas from coming into the forests that were cleared to start the tea cultivation. So Nagas was coming down because you've taken their land. So there were skirmishes, and then the British punitive expeditions had started sending into Naga Hills to annex the region, to have, you know, pacify the Naga and saying that, okay, don't come and destroy or loot trains or this other things. So that is how the history is. And then there were a lot of Naga resistance to the British annexation. So you have 1879 war, then you have in Pangti. So there are different, all these historical records are there, and people have written about the history of annexation. Several books available.
Thank you for a very precise explanation on that one, actually. Now, coming to, as we have talked about the colonization and the coming of missionaries and all, one of the aspects that comes into, pops up very prominently is the aspect of conversion. Now, you have a chapter on the book, edited book by the title God Rots, and you have a chapter on conversion. And that is where you kind of delve into the aspect of conversion. Now, your book also talks about conversion, but then I think that books gives more concrete way of trying to understand conversion among the Lagas. Now, many people have also thought about this aspect and then have written on this one. But then I wanted to listen to your perspective on the aspect of conversion among the Nagas.
Okay. The chapter in the book called God Roads that is edited by Peter Berger and Sarveshwar Sahu, it's almost like a condensation of my book. So, those who have read the book and the chapter will say, there are things. But yes, it is a condensation, because when I was invited to take part in the conference and then to write a chapter, I said, look, actually, when my book came out in 2012, because the book also, I must say that after completing my thesis, I did several other projects. And then from 2009 to 2011, I was at the Max Planck Institute of Religious and Ethnic Diversity. And there I got a chance to do my postdoctoral work and also to revise my doctoral thesis, combine it with my postdoctoral work and publish it. So that's why it took almost kind of from 2001, it took 2012 for the book to come out. And now again, a second edition is coming out, which is being published by Dimapur-based publisher, Heritage Publishing House, and it should be coming out by the end of this year. So it's almost like 10 plus 10 plus 10. But yes, so there were in the chapter is a gist of my book, where I have not gone into the details of ethnography, of conversion, but talking mostly about the peace. And it just so happens today, 2nd of October, and we celebrate both Gandhi Jayanti and about Lal Bahadur Shastri Ji, and the peace, the non-violence, another thing. And that's what Christianity and how it is being used as in the part of the healing process. And my book was about how healing is the thread that joins the traditional religion aspect from individual, community, and now a pan-nation healing of the Naga people through reconciliation efforts that is being made by Christian community as such, involving civil society, Christian church, the churches. So how, so that is the thread that runs through. And the conversion has many reasons. And that is what was, because my interest was, why are these traditional healers converting? How come they have converted and still continue to do their traditional healing? Isn't there a clash between the belief systems? Joel Robbins and others, especially this anthropology of Christianity, they talk about this Pauline rupture and things. And I said, where is the rupture? Because even in my 1 month study, the initial study, I could see the overlapping, where you have something separating, but then coming together, then separating their parts of it. Is it cultural? Is it religious? What it is? Is it to do with, identity in inverted commas? Because identity is a very large issue. So that is where, because that's where I feel that, having been going to Nagaland, especially the Angami area from 1980s, in the mid-1980s, continuing till 2011 when I wrote the book, I came across so many different reasons. People will talk to me. And I think that is something with an anthropologist, that you are ready to listen to every point of view without countering any point of view. You have to leave your cultural baggage behind and listen. And observation and listening is very important. And that is where I came to know that people have different reasons. And the reason is related to the youngsters coming away from their village, trying to belong to a community, and then Christianity giving them the reason. Then they are finding something that actually then attracts them to the religion itself, the prayer, another thing. Then I came across individuals who said that in 1956, when their villages were burnt by Indian Army, they had to spend several months in the forests, and all the taboos that they were supposed to observe and the rituals, they could not. They had to eat certain meat, which was tabooed. And this was actually the Dr. Vissia Sanyu who told me, and now he's written in his autobiography also, so things like that. Look, when we are breaking taboos, then you feel that, okay, now how do I get out of this? And then also is the thing that, okay, the Christianity gives me to hold on to a religion, gives a belief. And so there were different reasons, people said. Then also the idea of the truth. Okay, my religion is not the true religion. What are the missionaries teaching? What are they bringing? So it is a very slow process. And then as I also write in the, both in the chapter, more in the chapter and in the book, that how there have been, people talk about backsliding and other things. How do you say that I'm Christian and this person is not Christian? How to differentiate that? How the even the ban on rice beer drinking came in, because that and there were debates. And this is what I found very interesting. I had an opportunity in 95 to go to Washington, D.C. and from there to Valley Forge, where the American Baptist Historical Archives was, Society Archives were. And it was amazing to read the letters written by E.W. Clarke in paper-thin onion sheets on both sides. It's so difficult. And he has a scrawly hand. So, very difficult to read. I mean, towards the later years, they had started saying typed letters to the home board. But seeing the handwritten letters and the letters to home board don't appear in the reports that one gets, like that. There is one 1896 convention where a lot of people working on Christianity referred to that Baptist missionary report, where a lot of Baptist missionaries have written about the field areas. But in the letters comes out all the debates between the missionaries, all the disagreements. And I was amazed at looking at the things that we take it as normal, that there is a, everybody wanted, ban on rice beer and it was done. No, there were debates. E.W. Clarke was against it. Perrine and Haggard really wanted it. They had just come in. And E.W. Clarke saying that, what is these youngsters? They want to bring this, very strong kind of Christianity. Then some of the converts themselves started saying, no, we want to differentiate between those who are Christians, those who are not. And that debate still continues, you see? In different forms it comes up, but it has related to IMFL and other things also. And what you call the rum politics, as Charles Jasse talked about it, how the Indian Army was plying people with rum, cheap rum. So, So there are so many things. When you are talking about Christianity and conversion, there are layers and layers. There's not a single reason that people convert. They can convert under duress to get something that Christianity is providing, or it is an internal belief because there's a connection with the God. And that is why you also see the Protestant and Catholic difference in Nagaland. that Catholics came much later, because it was the Baptist. And even Reverend Longree Au was very much against. Your pamphlets were distributed saying, you know, we have a direct connection with the God. And Fizeau also talked about Christianity being an indigenous Christianity. So sometimes we need to go back to what the leaders and other people were talking about Christianity as a form of Christianity for the Naga, by the Naga now. Because it's not just Baptist missionaries who were evangelizing. It was the Naga themselves who had studied in school, and they, some of them who were Christian, were invited by villagers to open schools. And while educating them, they were also extra Bible classes. Missionaries was also teaching for the British, because British needed educated people. So it was also very symbiotic. Sometimes people think, oh, you know, missionaries and British, maybe they were not getting along. But so in my work, I found that it was also medical missionary work that helped education. And there were so many debates, because the home board, Baptist home board, didn't have money to fund schools or to fund medical things. So they had to convince them that we have to get education. That is the only way Nagas will accept us. That is the only, that is what made the Au Naga invite E.W. Clark, Godhula, and his wife, Mary Clark. And that was the way in. So there are a lot of things, you know, education, medical work. Then there were medical missionaries who started coming. And so I have sort of talked about conversion, but also missionary work and what strategies are used. And it is actually a mission strategy used by many different religions. In Christianity, nowadays it is called tenting. So you do development work, education and things, so that the community accepts you, and then you can give the message, the religious message.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, I think you are correct in saying that, you know, conceptualizing conversion in terms of rapture, as, you know, Professor Joel Lopez has said, I think in the context of Nagaland, somehow it's kind of very different. And also at the same time, some of the anthropologists working on Christianity and conversion and all also have kind of said that, you know, this word conversion, can the word conversion be used and all of those aspects. But I think I kind of believe that among the Nagas, at least the word conversion can still be used, because at least they base their allegiance on something else. So I think that aspect is something which is very interesting among the Nagas, that there are multitude of ways of how conversion had happened. And I think that aspect is something that comes up very interestingly among the Nagas, and as you have explored. So let me come to the next question. Now, as you have talked about conversion, and as you talk about healing and then the traditional healers and Christianity, and as you talk about conversion of traditional healers, now, for me, I look at this phenomenon from the perspective, in my work at least, as of now, I look at it from the perspective of syncretism, now religious syncretism in that sense, to be very specific. But then, so how do we understand this? The traditional healers becoming Christians, and then also at the same time, you know, still practicing their methods or their way of practicing medicine and healing in that sense. So how do we really encapsulate and understand this aspect?
Okay, the traditional healers, now I'll tell you, when in 85 when I went into Jyotsuma, so when I said that I'm working on healers, even the lab assistant used to deal with herbal medicine and other things, so he told me a lot of things from Kohima Science College. Then other people who introduced me, one to a Temu Miem, who told me his story and how he became. And then I also met these healers called Kora Bekilimie. I don't know. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. But it is about those who have killed a river otter with their teeth, and doing that, they are able to get the power to take out these small bones that get stuck in the throat. And for that, one has to understand the food habits, that there are a lot of fish and other small birds and animals that are eaten. And the way the bones are chewed, it's very easy. It might be quite frequent that you find a bone stuck in the throat. So they get a power to get it down. So though, you know, you eat rice and things. But they told me, so I said, okay, so then, you know, and so you have to do certain rituals and this and that. They said, no, they didn't really have to do rituals as such. They had to observe certain things. And then they said, oh, then I said, oh, so you are not Christian. Are you Christian? He said, oh, we are all Christian. He's Catholic, he's Protestant. But, you know, we became Christian, but our gift didn't go. So these are also seen as gifts that you cannot, and the traditional healers don't really charge any money. So all the money that is given to them is given out of, you know, as a thank you. They don't say that this is my fee, not like a doctor saying that, you know, it's like 200 rupee fee or 300 rupee fee. They don't charge. So whatever the person gives, it's fine. Except for one or two who have now opened shops, or they had a certain method of divination. There's a different ways of divination. And then I also, so the thing was about, you know, how does the syncretistic aspect. So there were some diviners who actually, there is also a phenomena of people called Tarhope. They're seen as a bridge between the living and the dead. So I used to hear legendary stories in Jyotsuma. The first time I went, I heard about a legendary story of a Tarhope who was able to, in her trance, also tell where during encounter Naga nationalist person had died, and his comrades didn't know where he was, and she was able to actually speak in that person's voice, saying, this is where I am and this is what happened. And this was told to me in Jyotsuma. And Jyotsuma, you know, it's very there are visual reminders of a Naga national struggle in Jyotsuba. You have a tehuba on which there's a large stone where it is carved in Angami, in Tenyadi, that the village was burnt in 1956 by Indian Army. There are these graves where it is written that, you know, these people were martyred in such and such date due to encounters. There's a whole stone where there's a list of martyrs. Then you also have a particular place where there is thing written that in 1929 these people were the signatories to the Simon Commission letter. So it is a place where, you know, memory is kept alive that way. So I also came to know about healers who had also worked, were part of the movement, and had some of them had learned certain traditional methods through other healers. But to come back to the divinational healers who had converted to Christianity, they told me that their helping spirits had also converted. And this one person in Jyotsuma, whom I met again and again, because I used to go back to Nagaland, and then I wanted to meet him again to get some more answers. And he told me that all of his family is Christian now, belonging to a different denomination, except him, because his spirits won't allow him to convert. And they would give him a lot of pain. And becoming a Temumia, the divinational healer, is not easy. Not everyone wants to be, because you have to be available to help people. And you might have to go through certain physical hardships, illness and other things. So it's not very easy. So it's not that everybody wants to be a diviner. The diviner is chosen by the spirits. So these are the things. I've written a separate article, but most of the article is there in my book. So, but when I came to know that, okay, the spirits themselves also convert. So it's very interesting. That is where I met some of the healers who were describing their spirits as white doves. And I'm thinking, you know, that, okay, you know, even the description of the spirits. But there was one thing, when I was looking for traditional religion among Angami, it was through the diviners I learned about the traditional religion because they told me about different kind of spirits. And then when you get to know into that, then you also hear the whole pantheon. Okay, fine, Hutton has written, but when people tell me, who may not have read Hutton, that what are the different beliefs, what happens, what they have experienced. So that was fascinating. And most of these people were Christian who were telling me about their experiences, and they were not taking me for a ride. Because that is also people can say, because in anthropology, sometimes people say, oh, Margaret Mead was, you know, told this, this, this. But, you know, they were just taking her for a ride about certain things. So, but no, these were being told in a very serious manner about experiences people had felt. And then I noticed that the other healers who were there, those charismatic healers from the Christian Charismatic Revival Church, they had very similar stories of how they became a healer. The stories which were so similar to the stories I'd heard from the diviners about their journey. You know, how the spirits come. And so that is how one sees. But, you know, there is a very important book by Jenkins about Christianity, religion in the everyday life, English everyday life. There's so many things that continue. So that is where the cultural and religious beliefs that continue when you talk about syncretism, like among the Angami, when a baby is born, you're supposed to take your spit and say, this is mine, before the bad spirits can take over him. So that belief continues. You may be a Christian, but you do that. And there is a change of name of people. Sometimes people say that a name might be too strong for a child if he's falling ill very often, and then you change the name. Then I came across cases where people said if somebody was falling ill a lot, the parents would say that I will give this child up to the church, give it to the church if the child becomes okay. And then you realize that some people have taken the line to be in the church as a pastor or a priest or something, because the parents have actually given them to the church. So, do you see? And I mean, so you have syncretism in this way. You know, there's a mixture and there's a diff. But then you also have people who say, I'm especially, there are some our writers who have written about, you know, prophecy and people who go into trance, especially during the church services. And they say, oh, they're just like, you know, the old diviners and these trance and people. So maybe they're not Christian. So there is still that kind of doubt in people that who is a Christian, who's not. And then the things about, okay, which kind of Christianity thinks about evil spirits and which does not. And here I will talk to you about a little bit about translation. One thing that the missionaries did was give a written script to all the languages. They chose the Roman script. But when you start translating the gospel, how do you translate biblical terms? I mean, I have a very small section because I'm not an expert in Bible studies. But during my conversation, Angami people used to tell me, you know, that there's a concept of sin, but the concept of sin among Angami is very different. And then also the terms, then they're saying Tarhoma has been made into an evil spirit, but our supreme creatrix, Ukepenapfe, is a Tarhoma with both male and female aspect. So, and then you see that in the Bible, Ukepenapfe is God. But you know how difficult it must have been to translate the gospel using indigenous terminology, which is meant for a totally different kind of belief systems and ideas. These are ideas, isn't it, in the end? Ideas about divinity and what it is. So how to use indigenous term? And a lot of indigenous scholars helped in translation. And this is again something that I think what I found in the letters, I was taken aback about the debates about spellings. That how Supli was complaining that Tanquist, who was part of the Angami missionaries to the Angami area in Kohima, that there was a committee that was formed for standardization of spellings by Charles Posse, the district commissioner, that, okay, all the spellings that are used would be standardized because Nagas speak, most of the Naga languages are Tibeto-Burman languages, which are tonal languages. None of these Bibles and all have tones written. So you will understand the meaning of the word in the whole sentence. And actually, this was one thing that stopped me from learning the language because I made so many mistakes and elders used to just laugh at me because the meaning of the word changes so drastically that you can end up offending somebody, you know, if you don't pronounce it correctly. So I said, okay, I'll stick to Nagavese and I'll take my friends and let them interpret for me. There's a dialectical variation in villages. I'm doing a multi-sided fieldwork. I'm going from village to village and dialect is changing, pronunciation is changing. So in that, you need a standardization of how to spell. If you're spelling the same word differently, you do not know which word is being used. So that is, I mean, of course, there is a commonsensical aspect of seeing the word in the context of other words that are used. But even translation of gospel was not easy. Which word to use, which word. And that's why a lot of Bibles have been re-translated. You know, our Bible also, the new one came out a few years ago. Angami Bible also a few years ago, they had the whole thing.
Yeah, I think the way you are explaining also makes me very excited because my work deals on all of this aspect, actually. Though some aspect I don't really go deep into, I really go deep into exploring the aspect. And when I talk about syncretism, obviously the idea of syncretism is also not accepted by all anthropologists. But then it gives me the privilege to really, you know, expand this theoretical horizon of syncretism. And in my field work, through my field that I try to expand this. And coming to the aspect of spirit, when you mentioned about the conversion of spirit, I think that's something which is very true, actually, because I use this word called marginalization of the spirit. So there are certain spirits which were called as evil spirit because they wanted to associate those spirits to the traditional practices, right? Traditional religious practices. But then there were certain spirits that were actually, in that sense, incorporated into the Christian worldview, in that sense, incorporated into the Christian worldview. And then it is still used today. So that aspect is something which is very interesting that I found among the house also, that certain form of marginalization happened, but also certain form of incorporation that has happened in the understanding of the spirit, in a sense. So obviously, the theologians, since I've read many works by the Naka theologians, specifically the Ao theologians themselves, and when they talk about sin, salvation, all of those things, obviously similar concepts are not found among the Aos, but then among the Aos, concepts are very different, though, which is not actually explored in that sense, because what most of the theologians, what they end up doing is that, you know, oh, the traditional concept like this one, which is sufficed by the Christianity and all of those aspects, which I actually don't really see that aspect of it, because I think I see it as a form of demeaning the traditional beliefs and practices in that sense. So I think that aspect also comes into really interestingly. So coming to kind of trying to wrap up the discussion and aspect and all. So how do we understand in today's context among the Nagas? And since you talk about the your work has been for a very long time, and how do we understand the aspect of spirit in today's context and healing? I mean, in your work, right? Because I think as we both of us also agree that, you know, there's the indigenization of Christianity has happened. So that is why when I talk about Christianity and when you talk about Christianity, we say it's like Naga Christianity or our Christianity. So in that sense, so how do we, or what is the picture of this Christianity among the Nagas as of today in today's context when we look at the aspect of healing and, you know, spirit and all of those aspects?
That should come more from you as an insider. So, but yet, I mean, as I'm looking from outside in, okay? So, because I'm not a Christian, I'm what you call a practical Hindu. So, I do my Diwali and Rakhi and others, but I'm kind of what is now in unquote liberal. Sometimes my students actually ask me when I was teaching anthropology of religion, madam, which religion do you belong to? So As anthropologists don't seem to belong to any religion, you know, also, because you have such an approach to understanding religion that it becomes a little, you know, it's a question mark. No, I think it. I see two kinds of Christianities. One is a very kind of a personal belief system, that people have a personal relationship with the God, because when you go into the church and when you see people praying, they are personal prayers. You know, so I've been to different churches and seen, you know, how, you know, after the person who has given the sermon, then people pray themselves. And I've also, when I stay with my Naga friends, we have, you know, there is one thanks the God before eating your food, whether it is every time you take, you know, your bath khabona, when you eat your food, you say that thank you for, you know, giving me the meal. So I would also close my eyes, and my friends would say, why are you closing your eyes? You're not Christian. I said, because look, it's the atmosphere, you know. If all of you are closing your eyes and praying, then I will also thank God. I mean, for me, all gods meet in one place. So the thing is, so I see that there is an everyday way of doing. Then you have people coming together in the study group. Then there are sometimes, I mean, this is the observation I've seen while doing my fieldwork, that how Christianity has become part of the living. So more people, I think now there are prayer houses, there are churches, there are large church events, there are churches in different languages. I mean, there is something called a religious landscape. So first, there are different denominations. And then if you go into Kohima and Dimapur, you have different Naga communities. So you have different language churches. Then there are different colonies. In Kohima, it's so mountainous that you can't go from one end of the Kohima to the other end. So you will have your kind of local church. So there is kind of that way the church has developed. And you have youth groups, you have church groups. So it has become a part of living. Everybody belongs to a church because all Nagas, Christians, give tithes. So your name is listed in a particular church where your 10% of your income goes. So it is a part of a person. And then syncretism has different meanings. You know, in theology, it has a different meaning. In anthropology, it has a different meaning, that it's this kind of a, you know, cultural overlap with belief systems and what are coming in, what are coming out. With a theologian, I wouldn't really go into a debate about syncretism because you are understanding it differently. And you're looking at what, because then you say, okay, what are the cultural aspects that have come in? What were the original meaning of certain cultural things which were initially not allowed? Even the dressing was not allowed because everything was part of a belief system and all the rituals were related to that belief system. So even the status gained by feasting your clan people or by gaining status as a warrior was related to a certain belief system. So you kind of say that, oh, you cannot wear this, you can't wear that, because it relates to the certain belief, which is not congruent with the belief in Christ. So, but all those things have come back. I mean, we read about, you know, how the British officers like Mills and all would take away the scholarship of, you know, government scholarship of people who were studying in the schools run by Christian, taught by Christian missionaries. So they had to change. I mean, Reverend Benvati told me that how, you know, he was getting a scholarship, but as soon as the inspectors would come, the government inspectors, they had to change into their traditional wear so that they wouldn't see them in their shorts and shirts. The shorts and shirts were not just Christian for them. It was also modernism. You see, you have to understand also, say, 1870s, might have been different, 1880s might have been different, but when it came to 1900s, there's a whole kind of modernization, what we call. That is also part of it. Why is it that we want to wear jeans and jacket of a certain kind? I mean, you can wear whatever. But this is also an identity, a modern educated identity. So all kind of things overlap. So you can, I mean, you can be like there were a lot of Christian in the British administration, but they might be wearing their kilt and other things because they were told that, okay, you have to wear your cultural tradition should not go. You may become Christian. So all kind of things. So I wish that somebody brings all these letters to the home board, because they have such interesting debates even about clothing. E.W. Clarke didn't want to ban the traditional clothing, because he said, oh, these people, they go back to the village and they are laughed at by the others. Whereas some missionaries said, no, they have to wear dhoti and other things or different clothing, because they have to stand out as Christian, because all the other clothing is related to the belief system. But now you see, now that clothing has become in some ways secular. So if people are wearing it during traditional festivals or during, you know, whatever gatherings, whether it is Students' Union in Delhi or anywhere else, or it is Hornbill Festival, there are still debates about it, what happens. But the clothing has become a cultural identity.
Our conversation is extending a little bit, because this conversation doesn't really happen much in the, you know, international circle or general circle of talking about Nagas and the work and all. But then I wanted to really go deep and explore on this aspect. Thank you very much for that, ma'am. I think that is something which is very concrete and which is very interesting. And I think my work will also add into so much of what you are also saying. Mm-hmm. So it will be really interesting to see all of those aspects. Now, ma'am, I know you are working in some projects with the museums, and also now Dr. Akudong and Tori Kikon are talking about repartition and all of those aspects. And also, can you tell us something about the projects that you're working on, and also the very movement of repartition that is going around?
Okay, I was just thinking that we were talking about healing, and now suddenly healing has become a focus on the talks of repatriation of human remains. I have been seeing all those human remains. Even Argotong, he has taught in Oxford for 6 months in the 2010s, I think 2009 or something. He was here. So they've been there. They were there in the museum, Pitruva's Museum. Pitruva's Museum has the largest collection of Naga objects, because J.P. Mills and J.H. Hutton, they have donated a lot of material, and some other people also have donated. But Balfour, who was the first director of Pitruva's Museum, he had visited Bokok Chung and also the Angami area in 1920s. So, and then he commissioned Hutton and Mills to actually collect specifically for the museum, and gave instructions. And you must understand that J.P. Mills and J.H. Hutton, I will call them amateur anthropologists, when they were administrators, they were following a certain notes and queries. This was prepared by the Royal Anthropological Institute for administrators to actually do how to study the communities they are administrating. So they follow a certain pattern, especially religion and politics. Then there were also more emphasis on the cultural aspects. So you will see they follow a certain pattern. And that is where I had found the gap, that there was not much about traditional healers in J.H. Hutton's. So, and though there were things about healing and diseases and sickness and other things. So, So the collections that came, some are very, very well explained. Those who were specifically collected and given the instructions, and some are not. So you do not know. Now, I had been working with the textiles, the historical clothing, and I did a project in 2005, 2006, where I brought back photographs of the historical textiles to the Lotha and Angami community. Lotha community got very interested. They actually contacted me. They asked me to leave the digital and the hard copies with them. And because the Lotha Naga book had been banned in Nagaland by the Lotha Hoho, it had some information which they didn't agree with. So nobody had seen those textiles. There were descriptions of those textiles and black and white photographs. So when I brought back, they were like, oh, but then, you know, there are village-specific textiles, clan-specific textiles also, and age-specific textiles, and many things. And one must understand the history of Naga villages. There were British punitive expeditions that were burning the villages. And later during the Naga National Movement, there were Indian army that was burning the villages. And then when the Christian revivals were taking place, a lot of material cultural heritage was destroyed. In the revival, I have met people who have told me that their parents had burnt the traditional cloths. They had sold away the traditional jewelry or thrown it away. Then later on, there were collectors who collected, and there were also Naga collectors who collected a lot of traditional things from the remote areas, especially the eastern Nagaland side. And they were sold to international collectors. So there are a lot of private collectors who have huge amount of Naga material. Some of them sell it to the museums also. So during these punitive expeditions, also Huttons and Mills and some other people, Fever Hammondorf, they collected the what were called the war trophies, which were there in villages like Pangsha and some other villages. So there were a lot of these. The human remains are part of what were seen as the trophies brought back by the warriors. Okay. And they were either displayed in the Murungs, you know, you have your Arju, Ban, Kichuki, whatever you want, the different ways you call them. Okay. And, or the chief's house, like among the Konyaks. Sorry, that's my. And so when they punished the villages, they brought head trophies back and deposited in museums. So in Vienna Museum, there are head trophies that were collected by Hammondorf. In Peterworth Museum, there are head trophies and bones and scalps and other things that were collected by J.P. Mills, J.H. Hutton. A lot of them were displayed in a display case called Treatment of the Dead Enemy. So, I mean, I have seen them and several Nagas have seen them, but I think it's only last year, it was the 2020s, wasn't it? When they were taken out by Peterworth Museum, the new director of Peterworth Museum. And because now the museums have also changed their stance, they don't want to keep human remains. It has been there for a while. A lot of museums don't display human remains. So when I did an exhibition in Basel in 2008, which was called Naga Forgotten Mountain Region Rediscovered, because of the collections, you see, when the Naga National Movement began, Indian government stopped all foreigners from entering the region. So while that region had so many German collectors and English collectors, even Americans going through it and collecting, especially in the late 19th century and in 20th century. So we have collections in Berlin, which are from the first Christian village in Mokokchung area. So they had gone there then. In 1890s, the collections were made, 1880s, 1890s. So it's very interesting history of Christianity, people. And so who are the people who were giving away these things? Had they become Christian? That's why they were giving away, or there was some kind of a trade. You know, you have to also think that there could be punitive expedition under duress, but also some people might be giving away because they don't have any use for the material, or they are selling it, or they are actually manufacturing things to be sold. Like you have in Hornbill Festival, where you can buy traditional things because they are being manufactured to be sold as souvenir. So So this is the thing about, so when we look at human remains, I mean, I had given a talk to Naga scholars in 2020 about it, you know, the collection history, that where there are photographs of Pangsha village being burned, there are photographs of the of that particular head trophy in situ in the village, and then it is in the accession register, then it's in display in the museum. But what is the history? The Pangsha village, even though things had been, you know, talked with each other and it would have ended there, but to show all the other villages that, okay, if you do anything against, which we do not like, then we are going to punish it. And the whole village was burnt. Then village burning mean you're burning all the grain and everything. So it's a very terrible part of history. And this is what I think when you think about the head trophies, but it's not just head trophies. There are also secondary burial skulls from the Konyak region, which would have been taken from the burial sites. Because these are, I mean, some skulls and all are very identified as which village, but a lot of other things you cannot really identify. So I don't know how they're going to work it out, but I think FNR is helping them going to the villages. And but my interest was about, you know, how the healing of the land has become. And I was thinking that healing has become, there are different kinds of healing. And it is the history. So you cannot take away the political and social and religious history of the region. Because even having collections there, what is the history behind it? And why till now nobody bothered about it? Why now? That is a question as a researcher, as a scholar, that these are the questions that come up, that is it the time? How come so many people have seen those trophies, but nobody thought of bringing them back? So it is like two sides. The museums are ready and they are reaching out. And are the people also ready to bring that? Okay, certain things have been taken, what things we want back and what we don't want. So as I was telling you, I've brought, you know, a lot of communities have seen the historical clothing. Actually, in 2021, last year, there was a whole project in Pitt River's museum where they were photographing certain textiles. And there were four different communities. There were some individual members and some community members from Nagaland who have seen the historical textiles in real time over Zoom from the collections. So we arranged that. I mean, imagine, you know, in areas where getting to take the cameras into the research room, spread out textiles, zoom into them, and actually show it to the weavers and women's community members and elders who had gathered. It was not a very big group because it's not very easy to organize people to come together to see. But museum and those who were interested. And now I think Nagaland government has given a directive that all the traditional attire should be described, documentation of traditional attire. But a lot of women communities have already started doing that. And that's when I had shown it to the Lotha women community, who brought out a book. Then the Sumi Naga, two ladies came to look at the historical textiles in Pitt River's Museum in 2012. They brought out a book of their attires. Then we also liaisoning with the Aonaga Women's Committee, who wanted to include the historical textiles. I had met them in 2019, and I asked them whether they knew about the historical textiles. And they said they did not know that they were actual textiles, because one researcher from Zurich had done a whole thesis on Aonaga textiles. But they had not understood. They did not know that there were actually historical Aonaga textiles dating from 1870s, 1890s, and 1900. So many of them, and photographs. in the museums. So I showed them, and high quality photographs have been sent by the museum to them with all the details, because there are village details of the weavers. And so, I mean, there are all these things happening with the Zeme also, with some other groups also. So these things are happening, and I've been liaisoning. I think it's time, because Naga, those people who have hosted me, and they have shown such generosity. I think if I can even do a little bit of just connecting and getting, that would be so. I hope that, you know, with this new project that Dolly and Arco are doing, that maybe it will bring a group of Naga elders here to actually see not just the human remains, but other things, because almost every display case in Pitt Rivers Museum has something from the Naga communities. And a lot of it is in storage, okay? Not everything can be displayed, so there's lots.
Thank you very much, ma'am, for the elaborate explanation on your current research work and project that you are doing. Now, there can be so many conversations that can be generated through your book itself, but also at the same time, your current project also sounds very fascinating. So I think next time we'll catch up and then talk about your current project, and hopefully we'll be able to do that. Now, I'm sure many people like to get in touch with you and ask about your research work, and also at the same time collaborate with you. So how do people reach out to you?
Oh, they can write to me on my email, vibha.joshi@anthro.ox.ac.uk. I'm a research affiliate at the School for Anthropology and Museum Ethnography at Oxford. I'm also a guest fellow at Tübingen University. I teach anthropology MSc students there. So that's the best way to reach me by email.
Yeah. Thank you very much, ma'am, for being here. Yeah.
Thank you so much. We talked about a lot of things, and I am looking forward to reading more of your articles. Go through them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Thank you very much, ma'am. Do take care, and hopefully we'll soon catch up regarding your work. Thank you.